update from Stepzone Group on private equity. Tim, did you want to introduce us?
Yes. So private or Stepzone has two services they provide to Cesera. One is private equity advisory services. So they help us to conduct a forward pacing analysis to determine how much to deploy on a year-by-year basis to get up to our target index, provide us with a market overview of what's attractive, and provide us with their research that we then supplement with our internal research to find the strategy we like. So first, we're going to have the private equity group provide their updated forward pacing analysis, view of the market, and reflect on our performance. And they're going to be followed by the private credit group, which implements our private credit program on a fund of one basis. So they are, we have a discrete fund that just, we're the only one in it going into the private credit space. So first, with the private equity, Natalie Walker and Tom Kecker here to present and report on the credit.
Great. Welcome.
Good morning. Thank you for having us. My name is Tom Keck. Natalie Walker, you all know fairly well. I'm one of the founders and the head of research at Stepzone. I'll give you a quick firm overview, talk through the market, and then Natalie will cover private equity portfolio performance. As you know, Stepzone is a global private markets-focused firm. We're up to about 500 employees in 19 offices around the world. We're managing about $270 billion in private markets allocations across private equity, private real estate, infrastructure, and private debt. That works out to deploying about $35 to $40 billion a year across those areas, investing in primary funds, co-investments, secondaries, and doing SMAs like the private credit SMA that you all have. Over the past year, we have been investing, obviously, in our people, but also in the future of the firm. So about 6 weeks ago, we announced the promotion of Scott Hart, who was one of our first hires when we started the firm, to the position of co-CEO alongside my partner, Monty Brehm. Scott is about the age now that we were when we started the firm. The firm's a little more complex to manage today than it was back then when we were, you know, four people in my front room. So Scott is going to spend time with Monty, learning the role and kind of securing the future of the firm and kind of the strategic direction that we want as a group. One of Scott's roles had been heading up as a co-head of our co-investment business. That he will be replaced in that specific role by Lindsay Creighton, one of our partners in our New York office. And then I guess the other notable appointment that we've made recently is a head of ESG, managing director in our Sydney office, Suzanne Tavel, is managing not only our ESG policies with respect to how we manage our own business, but really thinking carefully about how we look at those factors in doing our due diligence of investment opportunities that we're putting together. I guess the other trend that I personally have been working a lot on recently has just been the movement amongst large institutions globally to consider private markets as more of a one holistic group rather than four separate buckets. You all, I think, were one of the early innovators in heading in that direction, but we've definitely seen a lot of very sophisticated investors that are starting to think about them more holistically and even thinking about them holistically with their traditional portfolios. Equity is equity, debt is debt, and understanding the factor exposures that you have across all different ways of getting equity exposure rather than thinking about public equities and private equities separately. So we've been developing tools and techniques to help our clients think about their portfolios in a more holistic way. I'll talk through a bit of the private equity market overview. It'll be a lot more interesting for both of us. If there's any questions, please just fire away. I'm going to start on slide five. which is a slightly complicated slide. So you've got the blue bars and the green bars. These are representing the spread between private equity performance and the MSCI All World Index for funds that started in each of the vintage years noted on the x-axis. So what you notice is that the blue bars are all a pretty wide spread. That's top quartile private equity. Has a pretty wide spread over public markets over the last 20 years. The green bars are the median private equity performance. And even that performance has a spread in just about every year over the last 20 years. I think 2009 or 2008 is slightly below. But these green bars and the blue bars, if you've been watching this chart over the past 5 or 6 years, these spreads have been gradually increasing over time. So as the recovery has deepened and lengthened, the performance of private equity relative to public markets has steadily improved. I think part of the reason is, and we'll talk a little bit about valuations in private markets, Vera's mentioned that multiples in the public markets have been going up fairly substantially. They have appreciated more than multiples in the private markets. And so they were outperforming while those multiples were growing fast. But as those multiples have stopped growing as fast, that private equity has been catching up.
Scott?
Question for you. You undoubtedly heard the discussion earlier about benchmarks. So you've got plate 5 or slide 5 against the MSCI World Index. So any thoughts on the prior discussion about what an appropriate benchmark is for private equity?
It's something that our clients all struggle with. Because there are different roles. What Tim mentioned, all private equity benchmarks that you think about are not fundamentally investable. So if you think about the 5 or 6 characteristics that you would like to have in a benchmark, you'd love to be able to invest in it. But unfortunately, most of the benchmarks that we deal with fail that part of the test. So what we have here, so we have lots of our clients who use a public benchmark like the S&P or the MSCI with some sort of a spread to compensate for illiquidity. 400 basis points is quite a bit higher than most. Our clients are typically around 200 to 300 basis points. But that is a benchmark that that investors will look at, and you need to look at it over a long period of time. One of the fundamental issues is what you see here is a dollar-weighted benchmark. So we have dollar-weighted the MSCI because the private equity performance that's reported is a dollar-weighted performance number. And so when you start comparing using a time-weighted index like the S&P 500 or the MSCI and compare it to a dollar-weighted performance, there can be mismatches that degrade the performance of that benchmark. So so we've dollar-weighted the MSCI to provide this spread comparison. And so I would say that the public benchmark plus a spread is something that's easily understandable. This benchmark is less understandable, but probably does a better job of capturing that sort of dollar-weighted versus time-weighted and capturing the timing element of private market performance. So the overall takeaway from this slide is basically that private markets have been a good place to be in pretty much every vintage year over the last 20 years. We'll talk a lot about what's going on in the markets. Again, private equity exists in the equity market, so a lot of the trends that Vera's noted are trends that private equity is facing as well. We'll talk a little bit also about capital flows because those can be a bit more impactful on private markets than in the public space. So slide 6 shows fundraising specifically for buyouts because that's the majority of your private equity portfolio. And as you can see, private buyout fundraising has been fairly strong over the past 5 years or so. The market has grown, so it's not a concern at this point, but there is a lot of capital flowing into the space. Slide 7 basically looks at how much of that equity is getting invested each year. And so what you see is that the amount of equity that's getting deployed, and this isn't perfectly comparable to the $300 billion that you saw on the prior page, but that there is a fair amount of equity that's getting deployed. As you can see, relative to kind of the bottom of the market about 10 years ago, the recovery, the right-hand side shows you where capital has, the growth in capital deployed in the space has been invested, primarily in the U.S. and Asia. The recovery in Europe has not been as dramatic in terms of capital deployment. Slide 8 just shows for the U.S. market transaction volume. Transaction volume is different than equity deployment because a lot of buyouts use debt as part of the capital structure. So capital deployment in the U.S. is about 60% of what we saw of the global equity deployment. Slide 9 is the same figure for Europe, much lower numbers than what you see in the U.S., as noted earlier. Slide 10 just shows kind of the stock of what we call dry powder. So when a private equity fund gets raised, it raises $100, but it doesn't receive that $100 right away. It's going to invest that $100 over about a 4 or 5 year period, calling down about $20 to $25 per year. So at the point that that fund gets raised, there's $100 of dry powder or capital that could be invested into the private markets. And so if you add up all of those, all that capital that funds have available to deploy, that's what this number on chart 10 shows you. And as you can see, that number has been growing fairly rapidly over the past 5 or 8 years, about 16% per year. The public markets have also been growing at maybe not quite that rate. But if you look at, this looks like a very concerning number, but you could also think about this in terms of the capital deployment that we were just talking about and how long it takes to deploy this amount of capital. And so what you see is, you know, at about $1.6 trillion here, and if we're deploying about $300 billion of equity, then it's about a five-year period to deploy all this capital, and that's probably about reasonable relative to the amount of time that you would expect them to take, maybe a little bit higher than what we would like. So this is an indicator, and you'll see a number of indicators that we'll talk about over the next couple of slides, where it's a bit concerning if you just look at an absolute number, but you really need to think about the number in context to know if this is a flashing red beacon or if this is just an indication that we wish things were a little better. The next two slides are excellent examples of that that trend. So what you see on slide 11 is the purchase price multiples that buyout investors have paid for companies over the past several vintage years. The blue bars are in the large end of the market. The green bars are in the small end of the market. And as what you can see is over the last decade, both the blue bars and the green bars have been increasing fairly dramatically. They are higher today than they have been really at any time in the last 20 years. So on an absolute basis, it's quite concerning. However, if you look at these multiples on an interest rate adjusted basis, and you can do the same thing for the S&P 500, the interest rate adjusted multiples are about where you would expect given how low interest rates are. It's a little bit high, but it's not a flashing red beacon that says, you know, something terrible is going to happen. In 2007, when we were looking at the high multiples then, the 10-year was at about 4 or 5%. Today, it's at, you know, 170 basis points, under 2%. So that difference in interest rates explains a huge amount of the difference in multiples, both here and in Europe, which is shown on the next page. So again, it's the multiples are very high. They're higher than we would like to see, but it's not a flashing red beacon that says you need to run away as quick as you can. And I guess the other thing that I would point out is you can't go find better multiples in the public markets. So unfortunately, we're kind of our only other choice would be to go to cash, which we're not recommending. Slide 13 shows leverage multiples. There's two different ways to think about leverage. One way is to look at the multiple, the quantum of debt divided by the profits of the firm. And that multiple is shown in the bars. So in 2000 and in the first half of 2019, the average deal that closed in that time period had debt that was about six times the EBITDA of the company that was the borrower. So that's a pretty high level of debt. That's in the larger end of the market. In the smaller end of the market, it is about 4.2 times. Again, these multiples are historically high. They've been kept somewhat in check by regulators who are encouraging the banks not to go crazy. Instead of going crazy on the multiples, what we've seen is the banks have, and lenders, particularly in the syndicated loan markets, have relaxed the terms of the debt. So less amortization, fewer covenants. About 90% of new loans in the syndicated loan market have one or no covenants. So investors are, the spreads have stayed, the spreads in the syndicated loan market are actually quite low. The terms on the debt are relatively low, and so the riskiness of the of what you get, we think, has gone up in the syndicated loan market. Oris will talk a little bit about the different part of the market where you guys are invested in what those trends are.
Question for you. In terms of conventional lenders, is it accurate, though, that in terms of debt ratios, those are lower now than they were, say, in the 2006-07 time frame?
You are an excellent straight man, sir.
So that's why I'm here.
If you look at the,
Tuesday.
If you look at the lines on slides 13 and 14, that shows you the equity percentage of the capital structure, or essentially the 1 minus this number is the loan-to-value. And so what you see is equity is a large part of the capital structure relative to what we were seeing 10 years ago. So while the debt seems riskier from the standpoint of you're getting paid less to take high leverage with fewer terms, on the other hand, you've got, whereas 10 years ago you might have a little over a third of the capital structure being equity in the large end of the market. Today, half of the capital structure is equity. So you've got a lot more capital behind you, which provides some extra an extra margin of safety. Slide 14 is basically the same story, but in European terms. I guess the other statistic to look at in terms of the riskiness of debt and where the leverage, the syndicated loan market is on slide 15. This is the interest coverage ratio for U.S. Large corporate LBOs. The higher this number is, the more the profits of the firm cover the interest that the firm is required to pay. The lower, the closer to one, so if it's one, then basically the profits of the firm only cover the interest that's payable on the loan. So this number got pretty ugly in 2007, 1.6. That's pretty small for a brand new loan that's being made. It's been pretty high since then, facilitated by record low interest rates. The base rate has come way down and the spreads are down. So companies are borrowing a lot, but they're not having to pay a lot of interest, so the profits are covering a lot of that. This number has deteriorated over the last 3 or 4 years, and so this is a number that we're keeping a close eye on. Again, this is in the syndicated loan market. This is slightly different than what you would expect to hear about when we talk about private credit here in a few minutes. So that's all kind of the overall story is prices are high. There's a lot of capital flowing into the markets. We wish things were better than they are, but we don't see flashing red lights that say that there's a crash that's about to happen. If we were giving this presentation in 2007 or 2008, we would have been pointing to a lot of areas that gave us a lot of concern about an imminent crisis that's about to happen. But what we're seeing here is factors that are higher or not as good as we would like them to be, but they're sustainable in the current environment. The next few slides the next couple of slides talk a little bit about the exit market. Exits or liquidity in private markets could come from a couple of different sources. Dividend recaps often are a source of liquidity. That market has been quite robust up until the past 2018 and 2019. Have been okay, but not great as far as that type of liquidity being available. The IPO market is outlined on slides 17 and 18. There have been some IPOs that have happened. Not all of them have been successful. The WeWork fiasco has put a little bit of a dent in some of the growth-oriented stocks, but the IPO market continues to be a path to liquidity for more stable buyout types of transactions. And then on slide 19, the secondary market. So these partnerships last for 10 to 15 years. Sometimes limited partners in a buyout fund or a venture fund might want to get their money back before the end of the partnership, and so they'll sell that in a secondary transaction. It's a three-handed transaction because the general partner has the ability to veto the transaction because you're selling not just the asset exposure, but the buyer is also taking over a liability. So the general partner wants to know that whoever is buying the assets also has the ability to meet the liability for future capital calls. So the secondary market tends to be a somewhat illiquid market for these types of interests. We typically see interest trade at some kind of a discount. Historically, the discount has been around 15 to 20%. In the last few years, it's been almost a 0% discount. Part of that is because the public markets have been rising. These transactions typically you buy off of a record date, but the close actually happens 3 to 6 months after the record date. So you get a lot of appreciation from the purchase price to when you actually have to close. So that explains some of the reason why people might be willing to buy something at par rather than at a discount. But generally speaking, this type of price environment shows that there is a lot of liquidity in the market, and so you're not getting paid very much for bearing illiquidity. So that was a fairly complicated market. I tried to get through it as efficiently as possible, but please, if there are any questions,
Jerry?
Be happy to address those.
Yeah, Tom, on 17, you indicate the second most fruitful IPO market behind 2014 in terms of dollars raised. My lay reading on IPOs is that this will be one of the lousiest years in a long time for rollouts for IPOs. And it's, I guess because of pricing and whatnot, and because it hasn't been a good year for IPOs. So
I suppose it depends on what your perspective is. So okay. If you're a buyer in an IPOs, it probably hasn't been very good, whereas some of the biggest IPOs that have come out have performed quite poorly. If you are a company that's raising capital in the IPO market, it actually has been just fine. I think a lot of times the financial press tries to, they're trying to sell newspapers. So you sell a lot more newspapers by highlighting problems than by talking about things that are working well. If everything is working fine, then nobody wants to read a story about that. So as far as capital raising goes, it's been fine. But the performance hasn't been great.
Yeah, so I don't know what the percentage is on it, but I mean, these are the two revenue sources primarily for an IPO would be private capital markets, but also stock prices. And yet the stock prices have, I don't know whether or not it's been mispriced, the markets are not doing a good job or whatever. And then you look at these lockup periods. By the time the lockup period rolls around, a lot of these people that have been locked up want out, and then the price drops again. So I just, I don't know whether or not that, I'm just having trouble equating whether or not that's as good a business opportunity for private equity as it might be if the IPOs were in better shape.
So I'm definitely not a public market expert, so I can't speak to what's driving the performance of the IPOs once they get out. I do know that there are a number of private companies that are in registration to go public. It's not the primary source of liquidity for private markets. It is a source of liquidity.
The private equity.
That's right.
Right, okay.
So for buyouts, about 40 to 50% of the exits in buyouts are actually a sale from one financial sponsor to another financial sponsor. So that statistic is one that has climbed over the past decade. But today you see a lot of these private companies that remain in private hands. There's another probably 25 to 30% that go to strategic acquirers. So the IPO market is really only responsible for about 10 to 20% of the exits from the private markets.
And I just want to comment, I think the IPOs of Lyft and Uber have really colored...
Of what?
Lyft and Uber.
Yeah.
I mean, those have really colored the perception of the IPO market writ large. I think earlier in the year there were a number of quite successful IPOs, smaller companies. So when we look at this on a dollar-weighted basis, yeah, we have Lyft and Uber dominating that IPO market and have performed fairly poorly post-IPO. But we had Beyond Meat IPO. There's been a number of successful pieces in there.
And I think that's a good point that Tim makes, because that's why we kind of color-shaded the $75 million that's related to Uber. Because if you take out Uber and Lyft, actually the performance of the stocks have increased in aggregate, excluding those two companies. So I know a lot of the press kind of focuses on the biggest companies, but a lot of small companies have been successful IPOs.
It's kind of like saying, though, if you ignored the Titanic,
yeah. You
know, maritime shipping had a pretty good year.
Well, if you were crossing the Atlantic on some other boat, then
that's right. Okay, thank you.
David. Excuse me, on slide 5, those comparison percentages, is that net of fees?
So, yes, this is all net of fees. Well, the private numbers are net of fees. The public numbers are actually the raw index, so it does not take out any fees for the index, but I would expect that would be pretty minimal.
Okay, and so the private equity firms that are in the upper quartile in performance, that is why our relationship with StepStone is so valuable, because that's where we want to be.
That's right.
Right? So let me go further. Can you highlight more on that relationship and how we assure that Cesera is in that top quartile of managers?
So I'm gonna throw the softball over to Natalie to answer. That's really the million-dollar question is, how do we make sure that we get... And I would even say that top quartile is fantastic. The median is not terrible. Our goal is really to get you above the median, and if we can hit the top quartile, that's great. But we're probably going to – the persistence in private markets used to be that if you invested in a private markets manager, you had a 60% chance that they would – or I'm sorry, if you invested in a top quartile manager – get a 60% chance that they would be top quartile in the next fund. that persistence has deteriorated over time. And so, you know, our goal is to get you into the top half 60% of the time, and to avoid getting in the fourth quartile, hopefully at all. But, you know, it's hitting the top quartile number for a diversified portfolio, because this top quartile is a private equity fund. It's not a portfolio of funds. So I don't want to... It sounds like I'm making an excuse, but basically it's to keep the expectations realistic for a portfolio of funds. If we can hit the top quartile, that's great, but that would really be something.
Well, in this environment where so much money is chasing private equity, the competition for those groups with better returns is steeper and steeper. And so how does StepStone help assure us that we're going in the right direction? Because if we're in the lower half, mm-hmm. then we might as well just be in public markets, right?
Agreed.
Right. Yeah. Yes, I think a good slide to start on would probably be slide 21. So this just kind of provides a snapshot of the team that covers you, but I think important to highlight here is that there's a large team, as Tom mentioned, close to 500 professionals behind us that are sector focused and strategy focused, and so really kind of leveraging those 18, 19 offices globally to source investments on your behalf is what our goal is, you know, to find those managers in the top quartile. Is what we're helping you to do. And I think just to take a step back and think about where Contra Costa is today and where we want to be, and we'll get into the returns towards the end of the presentation a little bit kind of more backwards looking. The program's in a transition, so we started working with you a couple years ago, and the goal was to go from kind of a fund-to-funds heavy model where you were getting access to private equity through a portfolio of funds, to take that model, take out a layer of fees, and really go direct. And so that's what we've done the last 2 years, and we can talk about kind of the pacing and what that means for the portfolio, but I want to just keep some perspective in terms of the transition period that we're in and where we want to get to be. So, you know, bottom line, you know, you've been kind of in line with median for returns, but ultimately want to get the top quartile. And I think just by taking out that second layer of fees, you're getting closer there. So on slide 22, just a recap of the program that we put together a couple years ago when we started working with you. Again, the objective here is to get you access to the best funds in a direct way, and really to be an extension of your investment team. So working with Tim and Rishi and others to really make introductions and make sure that you're leveraging all the research that's available on our platform, either through our database or through our professionals. And so what we've done is kind of put a roadmap together for the next several years on how to identify and gain access to those managers, and have already made kind of introductions over the last 2 years that have been fruitful in culminating in 5 commitments on a direct basis.
So we do have a question, John.
Jumping back for a moment to the IPO discussion, one of the ones that didn't become an IPO but has had huge amount of publicity is WE. That went from something like $47 billion in assumed cap, non-market cap, but recognized value, to, I don't know what it ended up at, but de minimis. Were we impacted by that? And any, if we were, any sense to what degree?
I don't think so, is the answer. It's the reason it's not more definitive is that because you have a large pool of fund-to-funds, I guess it it's possible that it could have been in that, but those are historical fund of funds, so it's very, very unlikely that there was exposure through those fund of funds.
The major backers of that are not funds that we were exposed to.
Good.
Yeah.
The major backer was a $100 million fund out of Japan, SoftBank Sufficient Fund, which has really, really been dominating the evaluations of some of the larger companies, including Uber and Qui. So their impact in the pricing market has a knock-on effect of what we do, but not a direct equity allocation into that.
Right.
Thank you.
Yes, Jake.
A quick follow-up on that. I think you spoke a little bit earlier in the beginning of your presentation about kind of what I interpreted as increased transparency in across the different types of private markets. And given that there is a legacy portfolio with different investments in it, I just wanted to clarify, you are getting line item exposures on the different fund investments, right? So if he had a question about WeWork, he would be able to go back to the holdings and identify that.
That's right. So fund of funds are interesting in that they're aggregator vehicles of multiple funds. So actually the underlying data that we get on each individual line item is sometimes limited. So we've worked with those fund of funds to get as much information as possible on the underlying portfolio companies. Sometimes it's as much as getting kind of aggregate exposure to sectors or geographies, and then that kind of bubbles up into the analysis that we're doing on an aggregate basis. But I want to be clear, there is lack of transparency in fund of funds, which is another reason why we're moving away from them.
So speaking generally then of the portfolio at large, how much line item transparency do you have now? Like what percentage of the holdings do you actually know?
Yeah, so if there's a good chart in the back. If you look at slide 33, so about 78% of your historical commitments have been in fund of funds. We're getting line item information on each of the underlying funds that they're invested in. They're not reporting to us the underlying companies. So, again, added layer of fee, one less layer of transparency.
But on the other 20%,
we do get
down at the company level.
And at the staff level, we do get, not on a systematic basis, but when we have a conversation with the fund of funds providers, we can get down to the company level.
So then you know. Okay, that's reassuring.
So on slide 22, 11% allocation to private equity. Most of that, as has been said kind of previously in Tom's comments, is to buyout. So we focused a lot of the market commentary on the buyout portfolio specifically, and we think that's appropriate for a plan that's starting to go direct to private equity. Other areas of focus include kind of special situations, so that would include distressed and restructuring funds that we would look to take advantage of in a market cycle. VC growth, as the name implies, can add some additional exposure to those segments, but also some growth in the portfolio. And you do have a sizable legacy kind of real assets portfolio, which we would look to get more in line with less than 10% over time. And I think that will start to run off as the years go on. It is a global mandate, but we do focus specifically on the U.S. There's select mid and large market funds that we're looking at on your behalf that do have a global orientation, but most of the investments will be domiciled in the U.S. So on 23, this kind of speaks to your questions about, what is the process that we've laid out to make sure that you're getting access to that top quartile. It's a collaborative process with our team and staff. As I mentioned, we are sector specialists, investment professionals. So Tom, myself, everyone on our investment team is dedicated to a certain strategy and sector. For example, I focus specifically on U.S. small and mid buyout investments. And at the beginning of each year, we put forth kind of our best ideas and top picks that include top quartile managers historically, but also importantly, managers that we think are going to perform in the long term. That research and that analysis is shared with your team. We talk through the names and which names we think we should prioritize based not only on your private markets exposure, but also maybe taking into consideration the public markets exposure. And then also have kind of just interim calls and feedback and checkpoints with your team to make sure that the managers that we identify at the beginning of the year, the research is being shared with your team, and we're getting you access and reserving allocation to those names. As someone mentioned, you know, access is key. So we look to be kind of the boots on the ground and making sure that we're working with your team to establish those relationships and negotiate allocation, sometimes well in advance of a fundraise. And then your timely delivery of our reports. Your team does work on the managers. We do work on the managers as well, making sure that you have kind of access to the investment professionals leading the diligence. And then the second piece of the equation that we do on your behalf is the monitoring and reporting on the funds that are existing investments as well as new investments in the portfolio. So part of the exercise on an annual basis, you know, starts now or a few months ago where we do an update to the pacing analysis. And that's on slide 24. So what you can see here, we take into consideration all of the existing investments in your portfolio and at as much of a granular basis as we can based on goals, strategy, sector, geography. And we update the pacing in terms of what we think the liquidity of the portfolio is going to generate going forward. And what that means for new dollars that will have to be deployed in order to maintain an 11% allocation to private equity. And as your program grows, the entire pension, you know, we're constantly updating our models to make sure that we're capturing not only that growth, but also updated actuarial assumptions. And so we've also shown on this slide you know, the projected growth of your private equity portfolio in the gray bars. So kind of starting with $1 billion in total enterprise value today and growing over the next several years. That's assuming kind of a 12.4% target return. And we've also included in the blue bars the 2019 recommendation for pacing of your program. So what that really works out to be is about $100 to $200 million commitment per annum and scaling over time in lockstep with the growth of your program. We've also included, just for context, the recommendation that we provided last year, which is in the blue dotted lines. The biggest change, I think, is decreasing a couple years' annual commitments in line with decreases in assumptions that were provided to us on the growth of the total plan. So just to kind of summarize the year in review, the goal on 25 was to commit about 25 to 30 million per fund across 2 to 4 primary relationships. And we're taking a fairly concentrated approach to this portfolio, just given the over-diversification that was achieved through fund-to-funds in the past. And we want to make sure that the commitments that you're making, that your staff's making, are meaningful not only to you, but also to the managers. So more sizable commitments to fewer managers that you can have a real relationship with and carry that relationship into subsequent funds. So for the 2019 vintage, you know, very happy about this portfolio that was constructed. It included 3 managers. You know, we look to be sector focused. So in the case of Genstar, Trident, and TPG Healthcare, all adding very specific sector exposures to your portfolio. In the case of Genstar, more of a generalist firm, but also some very targeted tech buyout exposure that you'll be getting through that commitment. That's a StepStone top pick, court title manager, been very active in distributing capital back to LPs over the last several years. So like the liquidity that they've been able to generate as well as the new investment opportunities. Stone Point Trident is a financial services focused fund. So again, providing some exposure to buyout investments in financial services. And they're kind of a best-in-class manager that's executed that strategy over seven prior funds. TPG Healthcare was more of an opportunistic investment to be additive to your overall portfolio's healthcare exposure. And we thought that that was also missing on the private equity side. So getting that dedicated exposure through kind of a best-in-class manager that is local and has you know, that breadth of experience specifically in healthcare and has built out that track record enough to raise a dedicated pocket around it. So that kind of takes us to where we are in the planning for next year. So slide 26 talks about the 2020 tactical plan. As we look towards the next 12 months, we're already planning the commitments based on attractive areas for investment. So one tool that we have is our StepStone heat maps that are kind of instructive in terms of where we want to put capital. Given this is a primarily North America-based mandate where we're specifically targeting direct relationships with buyout managers, we would expect the majority of commitments over the next 12 to 24 months to be in the buyout space, but maybe selectively, if you turn to the next slide, a couple areas that we'll be focused on in addition to medium and large buyouts is also potentially adding distressed and or restructuring funds to the extent in the future, because as Tom mentioned, investment periods are typically 5 to 6 years. So we want to make sure that when a market correction does happen, that there is available capital to take advantage of that opportunity, and having a manager already in the portfolio that's in the position to draw down capital when that dislocation happens is something that we're opportunistically keeping an eye out for. I'd also say, specific to like the current market cycle and not trying to time it, we want to look for distressed and restructuring managers that are more of a deep value play that can play throughout market cycles. So even when you know, there's high growth in the economy and purchase prices are high, that they can still look for value plays in certain segments or sectors of the market. So that's kind of what we're going to be doing over the next 12 months. And we've already kind of discussed a few names with your team on where we want to be prioritizing our time. Looking back, as I said, you know, the next few slides that I'll talk about is really kind of the historical performance, so really kind of weighted towards where you were in the past, not necessarily where we want to be in the future. But we did want to take a minute to just kind of update you on the performance of the portfolio to date. So if you start on...
if I can stop you just briefly, Trustee Gordon.
Question, Natalie, on the restructured distressed group, Europe and Asia come up as unfavorable, and just based anecdotally and a little bit on the presentation we heard earlier, Europe seems to be in a general state of disrepair. I guess it depends on who you talk to and where you are, but it struck me that that might lend itself to a restructured distressed investment environment. Is that... Can you just generally comment on the unfavorable categorization there?
So I would say restructuring and distress in Asia is unfavorable primarily because of the regulatory regimes that lenders have to operate under. So there are not as many protections in many of those markets as you have here in the U.S. and in some jurisdictions in Europe, for example. There are some jurisdictions in Europe that are challenging to operate a distressed or restructuring strategy in. So there are not as many strong restructuring focused managers in Europe as there are in the U.S. And so part of the reason why Europe is not as favorable is because of the lack of managers that focus in that particular area. On the other hand, what we do think is probably Europe is going to be a slower growth, more chaotic environment for some time to come, no matter what happens in December in the UK. That's actually a good opportunity set for private equity. It probably doesn't bode very well for the European public markets. So the extent that you are going to invest in Europe, we think that private markets and probably buyout managers in general are a good way to exploit those opportunities. But there's not it's more of a buyout area of expertise than a distressed and restructuring area of expertise.
So just back on slide 29, you wanted to take a minute to just discuss the update in the last 12 months. So you have committed to three managers, leading to three new investments, which is reflective in the annual change in managers' investments year over year. You've also, you know, kind of draw your attention to the contributed distributed capital. As you're making new investments, that capital is starting to get called, and so have had, you know, over $100 million of contributions and distributions as well. And that has actually led to an increase in market value, although the performance of the portfolio is fairly flat year over year. Taking a closer look, I know this is something that we touched upon earlier, but maybe to dive into benchmarks on slide 30. You know, as was discussed, there's no perfect benchmark per se, particularly in private equity. We look to benchmark the portfolio against two benchmarks, one being a private market benchmark, and the other being a public market benchmark, and typically with some type of illiquidity premium, as Tom mentioned. So again, we'll revisit next year probably the relevance of the S&P 500 as the public index, as well as the liquidity premium of 400. But that's the benchmark today, and I think, you know, we think that the performance of the plan has been above median when you look at private benchmarks, and has actually outperformed the S&P 500 since inception, despite the strong growth in the S&P and public markets in the last few years. But you have beat the median in every time period for private equity benchmarks. And again, that's not an index that you can invest in per se, but it does aggregate all the good amount of the private equity opportunities that you would be available to you, so you're outperforming that by a small margin. Our goal, though, you know, as we discussed, is really to get you closer to the top quartile, and certainly within the second or first quartile and on an index basis by investing with top quartile managers.
The other thing that I would just say, you know, all of our clients like to look at the since inception number, but once a program has been invested over a long period of time, that number becomes very stagnant. It's never going to change very much because of the way the IRRs get calculated. I would encourage the board to also, we have the horizon returns down here, and to focus more on kind of the 3 and 5 year numbers on the horizon returns, because that will give you more of a sense of how you're kind of how you've been doing lately.
So just to touch upon the increase in value year over year on the next slide, you know, I touched upon the strong contributions and distributions for the last 12 months and the change in overall value of the portfolio. If you look at the chart on the right, the total funded to value, just wanted to explain a few things. So about $1.5 billion in contributions since you started investing in private equity. the total gain is around $636 million to date. And of that, of the total contributions, you've received about 70 cents on the dollar back to the program. And we would expect, just given the long tail with fund of funds, more and more distributions to come back in the next few years. And that's what our pacing implies, that just given where those fund of funds are in their life cycle, that you should continue to see more and more of that money come back. Those investments will be liquidated, and eventually you'll be left with a more direct portfolio of funds where you have not only better performance, but better transparency as well. And then an additional billion dollars of market value in addition to the $1.1 billion that you've received in distributions.
Jerry, did you have something?
Yeah, just a thought for people with older eyes and getting older every day. I do appreciate the transparency and a net figure. So often I get presentations that just slide right past the gross versus net. But the footnote is in like one point type. That may be the smallest type I've ever seen. So maybe, I mean, if you were to take advantage of the opportunity on page 29 on your fourth bullet point, in the future, to say something like the portfolio generated since inception IRR of 9.4 is net.
Yeah.
Because I read this as net of partnership fees and net of stepstone fees, and that's an important distinction, and it becomes an Easter egg down at the bottom to wade through those one-point type footnotes.
That's why you
teach
an
iPad and you can
appropriate
it. I have to do this instead.
No, it's a great suggestion and noted. We'll be sure to be more clear.
Thank you.
So again, I just wanted to place a finer point on cash flows on 32. 2018 was a phenomenal year just in terms of distributions back to the plan. And I think you can see on this slide, you know, for the first time, I think in the plan's history, and, you know, distributions were over $200 million in outweighed contributions. I think that's an important milestone in you getting closer and closer to a one times DPI, or, you know, full return of all the capital that you've invested in the asset class to date. And at that point, you know, you're really playing with house money, right? So everything else after you get 1x your cost basis back is upside. This year, more specifically, you know, this is as of September 30th, so the first 9 months of the year, you know, distributions continue to come back to the plan. We've been making more and more contributions that will continue as you know, your new investments call capital over the next few years. We don't expect this year to be as strong on the distribution front. But would note, you know, if you're kind of prorating it or doing a pro forma, Q4 is typically one of the highest volume quarters in terms of distributions back to plans. And the last thing I wanted to touch upon, you know, is just in terms of diversification. As I mentioned, it's a very well-diversified portfolio and maybe to a certain extent over-diversified portfolio. And part of that is just the large number of fund of funds historically. So you can think of, you know, the past going to private equity in an indirect basis or an indirect way. Going forward, you'll be going in a direct way. That kind of 78% of fund of funds will start to trail off, and the more and more commitments that you make, that 19% will start to be the full pie, you know, direct commitments to the asset class. In terms of strategy, again, it's weighted towards buyout when we think that's the right approach for a plan that's going direct in a more concentrated way. And we'll select, as we get kind of a core portfolio of buyout managers, selectively add in venture capital and special situations and growth equity names to supplement and drive some more alpha or outperformance in the portfolio. You know, the investments by manager, again, is kind of really kind of driven by your fund-to-fund relationships, which predate our relationship. Adam Street, Sigler Gov, Pathway are all kind of legacy relationships in fund of funds. And then as you can see on the last kind of bottom right pie chart, very well diversified by industry. We'll look to continue to kind of pick spots that we think are attractive investment opportunities from a strategy and sector perspective. And you could see that in the 2018 and 2019 vintages where we did partner with sector specialists, either in healthcare, investment technology, and selectively other sectors. So I think that concludes our prepared remarks. Happy to answer any questions from the board.
Are there any questions? Yes, Dr. McDonald.
With respect to us being in the fund of funds, do we just let those mature out and then when they do, take that money and put it elsewhere that's more advantageous? Or do we look to getting out of those through the secondary market? But if you do that, then there's not necessarily an opportunity just to move that cash into something new. So the best plan is just to let it mature.
Yeah, I think Tom touched on the secondary market being the growing aspect of private equity in general, and certainly you know, much bigger component than it was 10 or 15 years ago. But the secondary market for fund to funds is extraordinarily limited. And the pricing we've seen there, just from a fiduciary standpoint, is not appropriate for us to consider.
Okay, any other questions? Seeing none, thank you very much.
Thank you for having us.
Okay.